Hello there, everyone. Welcome back to TapCalf Transmissions. I'm Corey, joined as always by Eckhart's Ladder. How are you doing tonight, Justin?
Very well, very well. I've got my Timmy Hortons, so I'm
perfect, classic.
Feeling nice and cozy.
But also joining us tonight, we have from Electric Playground Reviews on the Run, Victor Lucas, going to talk about some Star Wars games as well as some Bad Batch. How are you doing tonight, Vic?
I'm doing great. Justin and I have talked about doing something like this for a while, so I'm very happy that we're finally doing this together. This is really cool. I know how passionate you guys are about Star Wars. I may not know all of the intricate details like you
no
guys.
No trivia today. Don't worry.
I share the love.
All right.
It's funny. The last time we talked was the Halo show. We did something for the Halo show on your channel.
Right.
And it's nice to like go from the Halo show, I haven't even been really watching season two, go from the Halo show to the Bad Batch, which is generally a bit more competently made.
Oh my God. The Halo show it puts me to sleep, man. It's just so dull. Like they're just standing around talking about this oncoming threat. And it's like, that's not how the games go, guys. You know, like we are in that threat. We feel that threat. We're not feeling the threat.
Halo 6, you just replaced that with the loading screen, so it's just the conversations happening.
I just wanted to point out too for the audio only listeners, because for those watching on YouTube, we do have the audio podcast as well. I'm moving out of my house, so I've got my dog and my desk. Corey's got nothing. Like Corey's got nothing, all in boxes. And Vic has the most beautiful set with like he's got the Hulk. He's got like every version of Captain America. He's got the Dune flyer. It's unreal. The original
mini
Star
arcade
Wars
machines
in the back. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a lifetime of collecting this stuff. I do love. I mean, I wouldn't have created EP if I didn't like legit love this, and still, you know, do what I do if I didn't legit love this. And I've always been influenced and inspired by all of these different, intellectual properties. And I think toys are going to be the last bastion of collecting, because we don't collect media anymore.
I totally agree.
And the businesses are trying to remove our ability to buy the discs and things like that. But I think action figures are going to be the holdout. I think we're going to be collecting those for a long, long time to come.
So, we did actually just have the release of a few of the Star Wars shows got some physical media releases.
Yeah,
it's
the
hardware to play it that's just hard to come by as well now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You need the game consoles.
Yeah.
So, Vic, do you want to give the audience a bit of your backstory? Just from me, this to me is the coolest thing. I still distinctly remember being 15 years old and we got digital cable for the first time. And I got a channel in Canada called G4 Tech TV, which was like an amalgamate. It was like a mix of the American G4 and then Tech TV. And it had all these really cool nerd-centric programming, like Vic Show, Reviews on the Run. There was Attack of the Show, just a lot of things. And I can pretty confidently say I would have been a lesser nerd without that content. So like the good thing I got the kind of the job out of it. So do you want to kind of share a bit of your kind of broadcasting history?
Yeah, sure. I've been a super fan of video games for most of my life, and I had this realization in the mid 90s that the video game community was really underserved on television, and I pitched a show to a bunch of broadcasters called The Electric Playground, and it was all kind of like Entertainment Tonight, which used to be about entertainment, not just gossip and out, you know, what people are wearing and whatever else it's about. And Siskel and Ebert, which was an amazing movie review show. And I thought, and you bring those together, especially in those honest moments, because I knew that players were going to be really sophisticated entertainment consumers. You bring all that stuff together and you go and visit the developers and you bring people inside the world of how games get made. You're going to have something pretty compelling and something I really wanted to watch. And I figured if I did, there's probably an audience out there for that too. And it turned out to be correct, but it evolved a lot over time because we were kind of making it up as we went along. In 1997 is when we actually made it to television. We launched on the web in 1995. And then through the course of time, we started as a website and we were shooting right from 1995 and putting, you know, demo pieces together and shooting interviews. We actually had you know, postage stamp size video clips on our website in 1995 that you had to download. And they were like 32 meg QuickTime movies that, you know, would take forever on a 14.4 modem or something like that.
Yeah,
it was crazy. Yeah, I met Ed Boon and John Tobias, the creators of Mortal Kombat, at the very first E3. And so interviewed those guys. And you know, George Lucas, I met at E3. We didn't interview him, but I met him. And, you know, just a lot of really cool things happened as we kept making a weekly show that we made in small batches and got new seasons. And then eventually we started to partner with networks. The first one was Space in Canada and then Discovery Science. And then eventually that led to G4, and G4 kept in America. They kept licensing shows from us. And then in 2008, after many years of doing some fun work with weekly content, we made EP a daily show, and that changed everything. That became an entertainment show, like an Entertainment Tonight, which is
a lot more people came on then, eh?
A lot more people. We needed them, like, but also a lot more viewers a lot more kind of awareness that this medium. And what was amazing was that we were right there as the MCU was launching. And so, you know, and our company produced the making of Iron Man and the making of the Incredible Hulk games at the time that Sega was publishing. So I was interviewing Kevin Feige and Robert Downey Jr. about the making of the game and the movie, and Stan Lee was right there. Like, it was so surreal, but it was perfect timing because we were the alternative to the gossipy rags that a lot of entertainment stuff was on.
Nerd culture, not nude culture.
No nude.
It was just, that for the ratings or...
some of those volleyball games, I don't know.
Well, we had a pretty good run. I don't know if we went nude, maybe we'd still be on television, who knows. It turned out to be a different kind of mindset because we were trying to talk to more people. But that lesson was wonderful, and we kind of pivoted to that, and then we made Reviews on the Run a daily show, man, we did some pretty incredible things, our little group of people, you know, and I'm so proud of the team members that I had and the, you know, the opportunities that I've been able to have and take advantage of over almost, 25 years or so, 26 years. Been doing this a long time.
Yeah, it's really, I think now, like, it's really a kind of unfilled niche, like, for traditional consumers, because obviously... shows like your, I mean, your show exists on the internet now, and shows like yours also exist, but like in Canada and specifically, like, especially now when Canada is such a big video game developing country, there is room for, you know, I think anyway, a traditional show. And it is kind of interesting to me how shows like yours, like Attack of the Show, X-Play, you know, they really were an earlier version of a format that's super successful now on YouTube.
It's but YouTube weird. I mean, one of the things that kept us going and we were able to pivot from and survive, like we survived both of G4 versions going away. And one of the things that they did that I think hurt them is that there was a similarity to a lot of their programming. It was all studio based. They would move from one set to another, but it felt like one long block of, you know, cool people, good looking people, you know, talking about how funny geek culture is and stuff. And I'm not trying to dog anybody, but that is not the thing that is going to appeal to more people. And I, you know, what we learned, because I wanted it this way, I wanted to be out in the community, I wanted to be out with the developers, and then we were out on movie sets and TV sets and everything, is that if you've got this mix of visual stimulation and the viewer doesn't know where they're going to be in the next segment, that's pretty freaking exciting. Now, you can't make every show that way either. But we had that, and we had this very special thing with EP, and frankly, I think it exists as a great, people are going to find out when we start running the classic episodes. I think
I was going to say, So do you want to, let's just explain kind of, I was going to bring that up later, but it's a very natural point. So you want to kind of explain how that's going to work, because you're making new content now, again, new content now, but
unless I press that go live button at the wrong time,
happens to everyone.
Hasn't happened.
Give it time. No, that hasn't happened.
Dangerous having a work from home office.
Yes, I'm making new content, and some of it actually echoes what I've always done with EP and reviews. Like, I do go to events. I'll be going to Summer Game Fest. Won't be at GDC because I'm too busy right now, but
yeah.
I do go out to studios, and I love all of that stuff. And I'm starting to shoot outside with Reviews on the Run a little bit more again.
Back in the day.
I missed it. Yep. Yeah. That's the whole idea. Like, get out from wherever you are and go outside, because everything that we talk about with this stuff, this entertainment stuff, is so sedentary. Yeah. Let's let the world in a little bit. That was the whole concept.
Yeah.
But what's happened with the classic stuff is last year I partnered with the University of Toronto, Mississauga, who is developing a really rich game studies program, and they purchased the Sid Bolton collection. He passed away. Mm-hmm. And I just gave you guys a thumbs up. and he passed away. And such an amazing person, too. I'm so grateful that the school has that library in our library. But they purchased all these incredible video games and all of this technology that Sid had accumulated, all this game technology. And then we started to talk, thanks to my friend Scott Jones, my former co-host on EP. He connected us, and we talked. I met a gentleman there named Chris Young, and we talked about maybe there's value in all of this work that we did with EP, and he saw it right away. And so we did a deal. He came out to Vancouver, and we bundled everything up, both of us with our minds blown by how many freaking pieces of media we had.
Yeah.
Because there's more than 4,000 episodes of EP and reviews and all the raw footage and just tons and tons of content. And so they're digitizing all that now, and they're going to share that under an educational license with their students. And they're giving me the media, the actual content, because it's still ours to use. And so What we're going to do now, because I have got a partner basically to digitize it all, is share it with everybody starting on Saturday, March 23rd at 9 a.m. And I think what's going to happen is people are going to say, "Yeah, why doesn't this get made now? Like, why aren't we doing this still? Because it was really good for everybody. Like, we were visiting everybody and putting all these different interesting people on television, and I think we helped to inspire a lot of people to think about making video games, and we were definitely promoting and helping to shine the spotlight on lots of games. So I agree with you, Justin. I think that there definitely is a need, maybe not for a 24/7 video game channel, but definitely for content that shines a light in a positive, fun way, like we always did with our content.
No, I agree, because like, especially with the 24/7 channel, anyone who wants video game content 24/7 can find it online
that
already.
That is YouTube. Yeah.
You know, but I think that was a really, really good, like, for me, when I discovered G4, I still remember the channel. It was 164. Like, I was into video games, but not the kind of person who would have sought out and watched a 24/7 video game channel or watched, spend a ton of time on YouTube. But, I fell in love with the show so much. I think I've told you this before, but I found an email I wrote applying for an internship when I was 20, or maybe 18. And I checked my Gmail. It's still in there. So, what's going on? How come I didn't get the hire? But
I was busy reviewing a ton of video games and visiting different companies.
It wasn't addressed to you, I will say. It was addressed to somebody else. But I actually thought the show did a really good job of showing off the city of Vancouver as well. I know you were in LA. You guys were in LA for a bit, right? But did you record in LA?
We would just visit cities all the time. We had team members that would be down in Los Angeles for chunks of time, and we had a regular team in Toronto. That was Marissa and Sean. And then Steve and Raju were reviewing out there. And then Donna and a cameraman producer named Leland, we moved them to Montreal. So we've had these different satellite teams for a long time. And then Jose and Ben Silverman, we're working with a guy named Jeff you're going to make me remember everybody's name off the cut, but lots and lots of awesome people in lots of different cities. Mm-hmm. And we were making it work, you know, and this was in the time when, you know, internet speeds, we could get them pretty good, but they weren't what they are now. And so there was still a lot of physical media. I mean, we used to go to E3 and I'd come back with like a Santa bag filled with 50, Beta SP tapes that we'd have to digitize in real time before we could do anything with them. And
that must have been scary. All that, like, it, the
yeah, I put it through the
losing the work
big time, man. I put it through the security screening things all the time. I'm like, Jesus, if any of these tapes get scrubbed because of this magnetic or X-ray machinery, nothing ever happened. You know, we did really well, there were a couple of times where people got sick at a party or something like that, or you know, but nobody ever, thank God, nobody ever got hurt, you know, we did lots of crazy stuff outside and had a lot of fun. We had lightsaber duels huge battles with stormtroopers, and we loved to play in the world of Star Wars. It was always tons of fun.
So back to kind of Star Wars, and I do want to talk about the Bad Batch. Have you ever met or interviewed Dave Filoni?
You know what? I have not. And I know that will probably happen at some point, but there's lots of people and friends that I have that could maybe make that connection, but I don't want to push it because I know how busy he is.
Yeah.
And he is like the new Lucas at this point, you know, he's touching everything. And that's official now, but I think it's been that way for a while. Mm-hmm. So I'm respecting that, but I can't wait to have a chat with him. I work with Disney and all the studios on opportunities for interviews and stuff, and they don't offer him up that often to any press. You just don't see him out in press that often. Like, he'll pop up at the conventions and things like that. And I think it's just a question of his time. Like, he's so valued and on these sets every day. But I have friends that work at Lucasfilm, which is wild, or work with Lucasfilm and have worked with Lucas for a long time. And incredible company, man. I know people like to dog the company and want to throw shade at Disney and all that stuff. But God, we have so much Star Wars content to sink our teeth into, you know, and not everything's going to be the perfect banger. But all of this creative kind of energy put into this galaxy for us is, I don't know. I love the Mandalorian, this Bad Batch show. I don't want to spoil anything here, but I freaking love the Bad Batch. I think it's an amazing show. But I've not met Dave. I'd love to meet him. I know my friends know that I would know that I would love to meet him.
It's out in the
maybe
universe.
One day I will. It's out in the universe. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good transition point. Why don't you give your thoughts on the Bad Batch, and then maybe Corey, you can direct the discussion on the episode itself.
Sure. Well, right when the Bad Batch was introduced in the Clone Wars, I knew that it was like, they're just special. They're just really unique. I think that there's this really crazy dystopian take on the clones in Star Wars that has been explored, and it's got a darkness like the replicants in Blade Runner, you know, like they just want to live. They just want some autonomy and they want to feel free in whatever term they understand. And the Bad Batch, because they're aberrant, because they're different from the other guys, they have that built in. And I think that there's not only a distrust, but also a jealousy baked into the other clones, because these guys have a uniqueness to them. Mm-hmm. And I think that opening season was wonderful. And what's happened now, because these characters really are so humanistic and so colorful and different from each other. And Dee Bradley Baker, I asked him last time I talked to him, I was like, how the hell do you watch this show and hear your own voice out of all these different characters? That's you talking to you, talking to you and yelling at you. Like, how do you do that? It's crazy. But he does such an impeccable job at making each of these characters distinct. And what I've noticed is that your favorite shifts with these characters as well. Like, Hunter was, of course, the cool one, you know. And then I like Wrecker because he's goofy. And I like Echo because he's, you know, like super tactical and weird. And yeah. And then I started to really fall in love with Tech. And I know that was on purpose in season two. Like, I know that they were...
We shouldn't say fall
me.
About Tech. It's a little
bit. I know. But I was like, man, this character is amazing. What a empathetic, wonderful character. And then gone. Oh, my God. And I've liked Omega all the way, too. She's just so freaking cool. And now I love Crosshair. Like, it's so manipulative, but it's
not. Yeah, it's not good. The dude's literally got a crosshair on his face. Like, it's, I don't know.
So, you know, long story short, I friggin' love the show. I keep telling people to watch it. I think that it's, out of all the animated work, it's the one to jump into. You know, there's less baggage associated with it, even though it's entrenched with the history and the future of Star Wars. You can jump in. It's not all over the place either. You know, there's a little bit of stuff that goes to, you know, what Hemlock and some of the other guys are working on. And you see the Emperor every once in a while, but it's not going from planet to planet and this battle over here and that battle over there. And
it's, that's the problem with the Clone Wars. It's way too much sometimes.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. And I love the Clone Wars, but I think the Bad Batch is, I don't know, it's unbelievable Star Wars animation.
Were you surprised that that this is the final season? I was. And I wonder whether they weren't happy with the numbers or whether that was always the plan. But even watching it now, I just feel like this could be a season 3 of 4 rather than, you know, final season.
I think, and I asked the writers and producers this, like, there is no happy ending for these clones. Mm-hmm. We don't see them again after this. Yeah. That's it, right? So they're wanting us to feel something about these characters, even introducing all, you know, Rex and the rest of the guys and making this kind of you know, reclamation and somewhat of like an appreciation for each other again, even though there's been some friction there.
Yeah.
There's this great aura of concern that they're building, and it's not going to end well. And that's good for Star Wars, tragic for fans of this stuff. I think what they can do with the Bad Batch is that they can do maybe short form side stories. Maybe there's a you know, an animated movie that they could do, which is just about one of their adventures and stuff, because, you know, they've tilted into being mercenaries and they've done a whole bunch of things that are kind of off screen, and we start a lot of episodes where they're already into action. I think that they could fill in the gaps, but I think this is a tragic conclusion. And we don't hear about Omega. We don't hear about these, and it's all part of canon, right? So we don't hear about these characters by the time we're into, you know, the classic trilogy or the Mando or any of that stuff. They're gone. You know, I think we saw it, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of the clones, I think, has popped up in one of the live action shows.
Rex and a couple of the other clones do end up in Rebels.
Yeah, Rex a bit was later, in... but. Ahsoka,
in
right?
Rebels, okay, right.
And,
Wolf was in Rebels, and he was in today's
the
episode.
One other guy.
Yeah, but Corey, what did you think of the past episodes? What were your kind of big takeaways?
I mean, I think I agree with Victor that, like, they're probably not heading for a very happy conclusion with them, but I think Andor is almost the best analog for the Bad Batch, kind of weirdly.
Yes.
Where we have Rogue One, we know what happens to Cassian at the end of all this. And even just the presence of Rex with only one or two other guys in Rebels kind of points to maybe everything doesn't go so well for them. But much like with Ferrix, we're kind of seeing how individual groups are taking their own approach to combating the Empire, and how the Empire's impact on different people is kind of what's going to bring them down. And it's all these little individual actions. Like we had at the start of the episode, there was Senators Chuchi and Singh talking about how they need a bigger movement with unified leadership. But so often we're seeing all these little individual actions and grassroots action kind of be what really eat away at the Empire in the short term, at least. And I think this episode really, with what we're getting through Echo and Rex, they're really highlighting that. And I think that's probably intentional.
Mm.
They do have their happily ever after planet. You know, they've introduced their forget what the planet's
the
called,
tropical one.
So they do have, and they've made a concerted effort to show us that world a lot, so there is the potential for them to, you know, convene there and we don't ever, and they're fine, and then the sun fades out, you know, and they're at peace. But I don't think that's
gonna happen.
I can see it being part of the idea of like these smaller individual stories, and these characters are out there somewhere. They don't have to join the bigger rebellion. They do their part of the, we're rescuing our clone brothers, then we're going to hang out on Tropical Paradise for a while because then our fight's done. But
I mean, what happens with Omega has got to be a huge arc, you know? Like, and I don't know if her story's over with the Bad Batch.
Yeah, because people are pointing out that the clones do have accelerated aging, and we've seen by Rebels, Gregor, Wolf, and Rex are old men. So, you know, you can make old men, you know, they can fade away and, you know, join society or whatever, or just die of old age or do whatever. Mm. But Omega, where she is, you know, there's something force related going on with her, and she doesn't have the accelerated aging and whatever it is that's making that, like, she's a girl where all the other clones are not. So there's something, it's going to be more difficult rather for her to just sort of be hand waved away.
Just this 5 minutes conversation here that we've had, just talking a little bit about the last two episodes, this is proof enough that every Star Wars fan should watch this show.
Right.
Like, there's so many tendrils. There's so many hooks of where this could go. It's fascinating, man. And they're doing such a great job.
I mean, I've got kids. And you have, what, two daughters, Vic, is it?
One daughter.
I know, like, it is also a good show to get kids into Star Wars because it does have the, you know, the very, in like, in their, on their surface, simple characters. Hunter's the bad guy, you know, Wrecker's the tough, strong guy. And I think kids really like that, because you ask a kid, you know, which clone do you like? Like, they probably don't care about Rex or Cody, but like, I like the strong one because he's, you know, strong, or I like, but obviously they've got a lot more depth to that. And that's kind of why I like the show.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything you wanted to mention about the two episodes, Corey?
No, just kind of afraid for that. It feels like the reveal with the, how they're making the clone X troopers. Mm-hmm. And that Crosshair, where they tried to get him into that program, it just feels like they're setting that up for someone, possibly Cody, to have, after he had his mission with Crosshair, to have been sent into that program. It just feels like they're setting up something in there that's probably not going to be super happy for one of them by the end of the season. So
yeah, that shadow guy, that clone trooper, he was pretty rad, right? Like, he could just slip in there, and like, he was so efficient, that guy.
I think they're trying to make us think that it's tech. He does the thing at the beginning of the episode where he does like the Mandalorian style, like, visor down. Right, Tech always kind of did that.
Oh, I didn't even put that together.
The face mask is so much like Tech's too, like the oval kind of scout trooper style almost.
I didn't even put that together.
To take on all the other clones.
Yes.
Do you think it is? I don't, but I think they're trying to make us question it. I think it might be Cody. But like, my problem is, I don't care. Like, I don't care about Cody, really. I like Rex, and I like some of the clones, but like, Wolf, in this episode, I'm like, oh, that's Wolf. I know him from Rebels. Okay. Yeah. Like,
well, yeah, it's tough. I mean, right from the clone idea, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's why, what the hell was the Star Wars clone troopers? Or the, you know, the Rainbow Six Star Wars game.
Oh, Republic Commando.
Yeah,
Republic Commando. That was very cool because there was a real, almost Bad Batch like premeditated effort to make each one of these characters really stand out. And that makes me wonder why the hell we don't have a Bad Batch video game. Like, what is Lucas waiting for?
Well, I mean, you say that about a lot, and I do kind of want to talk about Star Wars games. Like, I remember in our Halo discussion, we were saying, like, where is the Force Awakens Super Star Wars, like, you know, the double A game, or so I just, you were, you know, you say you started the show like in 95 was when you did the online stuff. That was kind of like the beginning, or like the golden age for Star Wars video games. What do you remember about that time, and why do you think it's so different now, like, where we just had the supposed Mandalorian based game canceled, and you know, every few years it sounds like we hear about a Star Wars game that's been canceled. I don't know if you've got a chance to try it yet, but the Battlefront 2 re-release came out, and it's pretty busted.
Yeah,
in a pretty fucked up way.
I was just playing a little bit of it on the Steam Deck in single player, and it was looking pretty good, but I wasn't trying the servers or anything like that. Just of Battlefront 2. I'm just happy to see that again.
Yeah.
Pardon me? No, not crossplay. They didn't do crossplay.
As far as I know, not yet.
Aspyr is not that big of a company, guys. And these licensed games are not high priority for Disney and Lucasfilm. I love that they understand that people want to have a connection with these games again, and I love that there's a company like Aspyr ready to swoop in and service that. But they're not resourced the way that we want them to be. They're not making this again.
Like Embracer is not, as a whole, Embracer is kind of in a bad place with a lot of what they picked up.
Yeah. They're struggling, but Aspyr, they're a cool company because they understand the value of these games and they bring them to different platforms, and there's such a need for that, you know? But Embracer's got some issues, but, you know, it's LucasArts was a very different business than, I think, Lucasfilm Games is kind of building back to LucasArts. But LucasArts had a real, they had a couple things going for them. They had the Star Wars license and the keys to the kingdom, and they hired a lot of incredible talent that were Star Wars fans. Star Wars is so, just like everything else that Lucas touched, Star Wars is so influential in the video game industry. I mean, you know, Lucas and nonlinear editing and Pixar and all the other things that sort of came out of his rebellious kind of nature for how to look at creating things. He was so inspirational that way. But a lot of video game people got their start because they went to Star Wars and then they went to the arcade and they went, oh my God, I want to have a career path in this stuff. Yeah, so a lot of people joined up with LucasArts, but they didn't want to make tons and tons of Star Wars games there and be only known for that. And Lucas was really dead set. That's why there were so many other types of adventure games and stuff. But eventually they came around to it. And they started to do things like the X-Wing series and the Rebel Squadron games and the Rebel Assault and the Jedi Knight games. I mean, those were a golden age for creativity with games, mostly because it was so small. It was just it was a smaller business. The team sizes were small. The budgets were smaller. Everything was a lot more contained. The channels were constrained. There was a pretty legitimate size install base on the machines that could run all of this stuff. And so risks could be taken and more of them could come out in a shorter period of time. When you're looking at a game like Star Wars Battlefront 2, which took a lot of twists and turns before DICE started to get that correct, that's just bleeding hundreds of millions of dollars during that path, you know? And I don't know why a Mandalorian game isn't being made by Respawn, but what I would hazard to guess is that it is, I mean, it's dollar related for sure, but I think it's also, were the right ingredients with the development in place to see a massive project with massive expectations like that all the way through? And was it going to meet a sales amount that EA as a publisher is kind of looking for, you know? And EA has got this, their business is to keep their shareholders happy above everything else. And if they've got a flotilla of games that can make $1 billion every single time.
Opportunity cost.
Yeah. And if they look at what the X is going to be on a Mando game and who knows if Respawn has that whole, you know, silo of people ready, because it's years of work at this point, right? Like, it's millions and millions of dollars, but it's also a lifetime of commitment from the people involved. And it's just higher stakes at every level. That being said, though, you know, look at this Star Wars Outlaws game that Ubisoft is coming out with from Massive. That looks fantastic. And what Respawn has done with Fallen Order and with Jedi Survivor, incredible games. Incredible games.
Yeah. And I think part of what you're saying, it has to do with, you know, the scale of games. Like, you play Shadows of the Empire. I can beat Shadows of the Empire in 6 hours, 4 hours probably.
Yeah.
Yes. You can do the same with Rogue Squadron. Like, I sat down the other day to play Rogue Squadron, or not the other day. This was like last year, to record Rogue Squadron. And I beat the whole game in one sitting. And I was like, okay, I wasn't expecting to do that.
Yeah.
But like, I kind of, versus, you know, I mean, not all games are like that. Obviously, you play something like Knights of the Republic. That's a long ass game. But I kind of wonder whether it's like an untapped market. Like, I know you're a Squadron fan. where yes. that was a double A experience. I recently played through the Dark Forces remaster, which was phenomenal. I thought they did a really good job on that.
They did.
So I don't know. Like, I understand why it's the way it is, especially with big companies like EA, where they've got, you know, say they've got 20 marketing slots a year. It's like, do you want to spend one on this game when, you know, you could slot in something else and use the marketing resources for that? But there's got to be somebody to
I agree. I agree. And I think that the industry is in this interesting midpoint transition to what AI and live service and the shakeups that these two sectors of the business mean to games. I think they're figuring that out right now. We're hearing about new AA and AAA studios that are launching. There's things like Sean Layden out in the news talking about his desire to see shorter games. Definitely price points are coming into factor. Things like Helldivers 2, which is a live service game launching at $40 US, is a huge win for Sony. It's also, you know, day and date with PC. And so I think there's a lot of, more than ever, and discoverability is an issue for everybody in any part of media at all right now, whether you're making a huge movie or a Netflix show or an Apple TV Plus or whatever. There's just so much out there. Disney knows what the value is of their brands. And I think what's going to come out of this is potentially new partners. Like Amy Hennig is working on with Skydance. They're working on a Star Wars experience. We don't even know what that is, you know? The guys in Paris, the Quantic Dream is working on a Star Wars game, and they've said it's not quite like their adventure titles. It's a little bit different than that. So we don't quite know what that means yet. I don't think we get that KOTOR remake anytime soon, but I do think we're going to have some new studios that evolve to satisfy exactly what you're talking about, because I think there is this moment of realization that these super long games paired with these live service games, which are free, it makes it really hard to find space, find time to play these things, you know? And I think 8-hour Star Wars games or 10-hour Star Wars games, there's a market for that.
Yeah, I've been on like a big Dark Souls kick recently. And that's like an example of a game that, you know, an indie studio just can't bank because it's so massive. It's so many resources, you know, they work on it for years. But I think about how nicely an indie game, like, have you played Tunic, Vic? It's actually, yes. It's actually made by a local guy from Halifax. It's a beautiful game, but you know, they, even though they're completely different in scope and scale and team size, and maybe most importantly for this analogy, they fit together so nicely. And I hope that people are paying attention to what games like Helldivers are doing, because it feels like such a missed opportunity to me.
Well, Vic, do you think you mentioned Lucasfilm Games potentially getting back to a position similar to what LucasArts was before? Do you think them potentially holding on to that publisher aspect might make it more attractive or more possible for some studios to do those kinds of smaller experiences without the 50% overhead or whatever on the licensing?
Well, I think anytime EA comes out with a statement like they're canceling a Mandalorian game, that doesn't look good to Disney shareholders, you know, and they suddenly reevaluate their partnerships and their relationships. I think if Star Wars Outlaws does really well and it looks like an exciting game, Massive is one of the best developers on Earth, I think, and I'm really excited to see what they are able to put together with that game. It's the game I'm most excited about for this year, as a matter of fact. I think that is going to inform Disney on some things. Bob Iger's been out in the media talking about they're going to be making some big plays for games. They just did this big, huge partnership with Epic. They're going to be building whatever the Fortnite Disney universe ends up becoming. And there's going to be, I bet you, a lot of opportunities to build smaller scale UGC type things. And maybe AI is a part of those experiences as well, that maybe tap into that marketplace. But I do think that Lucasfilm Games has accelerated. The fact that we've got this Indiana Jones game coming out this year is very exciting. Might not be exactly what everybody's had on their mind, but I think it's going to end up being a good game because Machine Games is very qualified. And they are taking the reins a bit more. You know, they are sort of starting to kind of determine the future with a lot of this stuff. As we're hearing Bob Iger expressing to his subordinates and his shareholders that games are going to be a huge part of what Disney's plans are in the future, whether or not they go back into straight publishing or they acquire something, because they know how expensive the medium is. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is an appetite for less expensive, shorter games. And I think that that is a good ingredient to throw into the churn, into the mix of things. And the benefit of that for the industry is you give people a taste that doesn't cost $100, and then they want more. And if they've got space in their time to play another thing, and there's more 8 to 10 hour games out there, or 15 to 20 hour games, mm-hmm. they're going to take that leap again. I mean, we did it before. The business did it before, mm-hmm. But it grew to a scale. And I think that the industry, I think where we're at as players and as evangelists and fans of the industry, people that have been playing for as long as all three of us have and everybody else that might be watching this right now, most people in the nerd sphere, is we just want games to be appreciated by more people. And I think the industry is trying to figure out how to crack that nut without making these terrible match three games that people are obsessed with.
But hold on, are you about to talk shit on Candy Crush in my presence?
Well, I mean, they're good on a ledger sheet, and they're impressive when you're stacking up billions of dollars to get investments and stuff. Like, you know, we fooled a bunch of people to play this crap game, but that's not what this medium is about, you know. And anybody that knows this medium, they know that we can do a lot more than that. I just think that there is also this tendency to like fill games with too much stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you're pointing at with the Survivor and Jedi Fallen Order. You could feel them creaking right under their ambition and the weight of all the things that they had. And maybe if there was just a little more slimming down on some of these concepts, the budgets and the hardware didn't allow for huge ambitions back then. Mm-hmm. So when they're making Dark Forces, like, well, we got our six levels in or our eight levels. That's good, guys. Let's ship it, you know? But now it's like, it's limitless. I'll tell you, a sweet buried treasure Star Wars game, though, and nobody talks about this, is Revenge of the Sith for the Game Boy Advance.
Oh, the Game Boy Advance. Yeah, game. I had that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome little game. It's a side scroller. You can play as Obi-Wan or Anakin, and it's made by a lot of the same people that run Tribute Games. I think Ubisoft had the publishing on that right now, but they all went and moved on. They did Turtles with Ubi, and then they went off and did a whole suite of cool games with Tribute, and they've done the Turtle Shredder's Revenge, which was an amazing game last year.
Really good game.
But you can see all of the fundamentals of that in Revenge of the Sith for the Game Boy Advance. It's a wonderful little title.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say the Revenge of the Sith console game, and I was like, yeah, that's good.
Oh, and I love that too.
Everyone knows that one, but yeah, the that is a good buried treasure. There was a pretty good Phantom Menace one, I believe, as well.
I'll tell you the story about the Revenge of the Sith episode 3, because I'm really good friends with the art director on that game. That was done by, what the hell were they called then? The Collective. So that was the Buffy the Vampire Slayer. They did the Indiana Jones and the the Xbox one. I forget now. I'm losing that. Emperor's Tomb. Yeah, Indiana Jones and the Emperor's Tomb. And this is a company that was just amazing at doing multi-port games, lots of brawlers. They had a great fighting mechanic. But they had 8 months to make Revenge of the Sith because Lucas was attempting to do it in-house and get it out. And they kind of got into a corner or whatever, you know, which happens. And they went, we can't do it. And can you come and help make that happen? And they made it happen. And they cranked and they put something together that was actually really fun. It's like a Final Fight, but in 3D. With cool Star Wars moments, and you know, they integrated the movie bits quite well, and it still holds up. It's really fun to play.
I do kind of miss the age of like when you'd have the console game, you'd have like a Nintendo DS game and you'd have a PSP game, or back in the day you'd have console and then you'd have Game Boy Advance or just right. regular Game Boy, and it'd be a completely different experience often, especially for Star Wars games, like the Lego Star Wars games.
The Force Unleashed,
yeah.
You know what I don't understand, Justin? That's an excellent point. Like, there are so many great pixel art developers out there that have been totally. Influenced by decades of game making, and every one of these games, these, you know, what are we at? $300-400 million budgets for these games. They should spend $1 million and work with an indie team and make a demake and make a like something totally that agree. Would look great on a GBA or whatever. We should play Alan Wake demake as Alan Wake 2 is out there. And it's just a scrolling thing. And every big movie should have that day and date, you know, full-fledged, something that would have cost us $40 for the cartridge for the Game Boy with whatever, how many hours that would have been, maybe 6 or 8 hours or whatever, maybe a bit less.
More when you're a dumb kid.
Yeah, but more of that type of content, I think it's so charming. I mean, you could spend $1 million on bus advertisements, or you could spend $1 million on an actual game that will live forever and have value. You guys probably don't even know about the Mummy demake based on the Tom Cruise
movie
that was pretty lame. Yeah. But Way Forward, who's in the news right now because they made the new Contra game for all the systems, which is actually pretty fun. It runs a little slow on the Switch, but in 2017, when The Mummy came out, it was supposed to be the beginning of the monster universe. I know I'm off Star Wars topic here.
No.
Way Forward made a Mummy demake title, and it's actually great. You can play it on a bunch of, it's a great Steam Deck gamer, and I totally recommend it. Another buried treasure.
Complete off topic, did you ever see the Mummy trailer with the mismixed audio where they so this is like the funniest thing ever. The Tom Cruise Mummy, you know, the scene where they're like in the airplane and it's crashing. So they accidentally published a version of the trailer that had only like one audio layer, and it was just like a layer of grunts and screams.
I think so. I did see that. That's like right. Yes. Yeah.
Nothing, or like some background music, and then no background music, just maybe a hum, and then or like it's hilarious. But
I think there's a whole like a shorts meme, like you know, TikTok meme on pulling sounds out of music videos and stuff that was probably influenced exactly by that moment right there. That's so crazy. That movie, it was so disappointing because Cruise was like throwing all of his Tom Cruise-ness into it, but it was just a bad movie, and he was just fighting to make it a good movie, and it was just not working, man.
You can't.
So bad. But the game is good.
Yeah, and I think about, like, you know, The Mummy 2017, not the biggest media project ever. The Force Awakens in 2015, though, like, especially in America and Canada, like, I don't know if there's ever been a juggernaut like that. Like, people talk about how, I mean, obviously, if you go back to like the true age of the blockbuster, maybe people talk about how Infinity War or Endgame earned more than The Force Awakens, not in North America. Like that movie was unlike anything. And the fact that there was so little for people who wanted to spend money on it to buy, like, it's insane that we never got even a shitty Force Awakens game. Like, and obviously they were.
We got the Lego Star Wars one, which I think is actually a really good game, but we also had the Disney Star Wars stuff, with the figures. What was that called again? Disney Infinity stuff. And there was some good stuff in there, but yes, it was too you know, safe. It was just really kid friendly. You know what, Lego Star Wars, though, the Force Awakens holds as a very unique identifier with it. It's the only game that Harrison Ford actually put his voice into. So you're actually hearing him in Lego Star Wars Force Awakens, which is wild.
Can you imagine how grumpy he was having to probably go? I don't know if he recorded extra lines or just ripped it from the movie, but if he had to go into studio, like, what am I doing today? A video game?
I think he's had a huge change of heart, man. I think the plane crash and all of the love around his return to Star Wars and being able to do Indiana Jones, I think he had years of grumpiness, and I think it's been realization that he can't do this forever and just years of gratefulness. That's what I see. Yeah. Like, he's tearing up in every interview I see now, you know? I was so nervous I was going to... Pardon me?
Sometimes the like his hate for Star Wars feels like it's a bit overplayed because like he was so involved in making the first three movies. Like he was giving so much feedback and helping with writing some stuff.
Yeah.
But like he's kind of got the cantankerous public image that he wants to uphold.
Yeah.
So I think it's always been a bit more of a put on.
It's a gag.
He's had I think he's talked about having some anxiety too about doing things like interviews. For me, it was when he was doing the new Blade Runner movie where I felt like he was really opening up a lot more.
Yes.
And I think part of it was having a co-star who he was sort of second fiddle. And I think that helped because he had a lot of fun with it. You know, did he punch someone in the face or I can't remember if he
Ryan
got punched.
Gosling.
Yeah. He punched Ryan Gosling when they meet and it seemed like he was having fun. I was like, he's doing a shot before each interview or something. But I mean, it also probably helps that it was just like an all time phenomenal movie, but.
That's the best Denis Villeneuve movie. And, he's incredible. And I don't think people would. I mean, he had the box office to line him up, but I think that peters out if you're a complete asshole, you know? And I think that if people were working with him and they just did not like him, he would not keep getting those green lights and those opportunities to keep going, you know? And I think more than anything over the last 15 years or so, it's just been a grateful Harrison Ford. And like, look, he's in that Shrinking Show. I don't know if you guys have watched that show, but it's so charming. And I mean, I love that freaking guy anyways, even if he is cranky, he's just like my hero, you know, like I grew up with him. So I loved Indiana Jones last year.
Indy 5 was really good too.
I thought it was so freaking fun. And I thought the messaging about, you know, people are vital for as long as they want to be. And you can lose that hope and that faith, but it's restored by the people that believe in you. I thought there was so much powerful stuff in there.
Yeah.
And it was just a beautiful movie. It just looked great too. You know, of course it's going to be not Raiders. He's 80. It's not going to be that, but I thought it was a beautiful send off, but I was so nervous. I was going to interview him. I thought that might come together. I'm like, oh my God. Cause he's just been, I mean, I have said one thing to him on a carpet once, but I don't know if I'd be able to hold my shit together talking to him. He's biggest hero.
I totally wouldn't be able to. I think people get, I agree with what you said about Indy 5. I think people get the wrong message where like they see the first half of the movie where he's, you know, divorced and Marion's left him and his kid's dead and he's all set.
Yep.
But like the entire point is he doesn't Luke Skywalker himself on an island. Like at the end of the movie, he's in the sheets with Marion. He's happy. He's like, he recovers after his kid dies. Yep. Like it's not an easy thing to do. And I always like stories. I thought you did I thought you explained it really well. You know, you're only as old kind of as you let yourself be.
I think ultimately even Luke Skywalker doesn't.
No, he doesn't. I mean,
in that sense, it's kind of the same basic premise there.
It's just Indy doesn't die at the end.
Well, does Indy become a Force ghost after he dies? He's got way less options to work with there.
He was still alive in the 90s, according to the young Indiana Jones Chronicles or whatever.
The 90s.
I think that's because in that show they have Old Man Indy where it's like he's kind of telling stories.
Playing
about
the saxophone. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that
supposed to be the 90s?
I thought so. Maybe not.
I think it is like 92 or something that it was. Although,
because he's like in his 30s when the Nazis are around. So he's like 80, 90 years old, I guess. Is that math working out? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's the 38, 36, and he's supposed to be, I guess.
Yeah, because it's right at the beginning of the war, right? So he's like in his 90s, but he's still
50 years to that. Yeah, he could still be there. Yeah, of course. He'd be in his 80s. But why is he in his 80s in the 60s?
That's what was throwing me off.
Yeah.
I think he'd be in his 90s because I think it's
You know what? No, they said they would have said 65.
Okay. So he just...
Right.
He was playing
they're
younger.
They're retiring him out. So he was playing much younger than he really was. But we're obsessed with him. Because we've all grown up with him, we know he's 80, and that's all we see on screen.
Totally.
I think there's just so much ageism and so much, you know, people getting freaked out by it. And I think that there's some people that got freaked out about what's her name? I forgot her name right now. The tall lady who's amazing, fantastic. You know, she's not Marion, but she was great.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I just, the thing that really shocked me is watching that movie, I was like, did I really think Indy was that old in Number Four? Like going back and watching him, like he's not that old. Like in Crystal Skull. It's like, well, like it, that kind of was like I was, you know, letting my prejudice kind of get to me when I watched that movie back in, I don't even remember what year it came out, but
yeah. It was 15 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
It was, That's my universal experience with Larry David, though. Like, I thought that guy was 80 since he was 45.
Yeah.
So I do want to talk about a few more Star Wars games. I just kind of give me, doesn't have to be in any particular order. Doesn't even have to be your favorite. When you think of Star Wars games, like from, you know, from time immemorium, which are a few that really come to you, like that had the most influence or that were your favorite or that you just think about them when you think Star Wars games?
Well, I love the Force Unleashed games. I was disappointed in two, but I love the whole setup. I love the ambition. I got to meet Sam Witwer and David Collins through that experience, and they become, you know, kind of friends over time. You know, we've been able to chat many times over the years, and I those guys are awesome. And those games were really freaking cool. You know, I love the character of Starkiller. I like the powers and the abilities that we got to have. You really felt the power of the Force in those games. And I think to some extent, we got a really good feel for that too, with the Fallen Order and with Jedi Survivor. Those are incredibly enjoyable games. I think I loved playing true X-Wing stuff. I think X-Wing versus TIE Fighter on the PC was a really profound, beautiful experience for me. I've been more of a console player through my life. Yeah. But I've had PCs all the way along, and I've dipped in and played. And so I think when I've played seminal PC games along the way, they've really stood out. And one that did was X-Wing versus TIE Fighter. I love the Battlefront. You know what? If I have to pick. Yeah, it's Battlefront. And I think it was. I think it was the first one. We're on Endor. Jumping into AT-STs, playing it on Xbox Live.
Yeah.
I played it with a lot of the viewers that were watching EP because I was freely sharing my Xbox gamer tag, and then we'd all just jump in. And I was just wasting everybody with my AT-ST, and I'm cackling. Like, what the hell? This is, I'm just like racking up the kill counts. I'm like, I'm unstoppable. And it was just so freaking fun, man. I think Pandemic is honestly one of the most beautiful stories in games, and also one of the saddest. That
I'm not super familiar with it. If you want to give me the Reader's Digest version.
Oh, well, Pandemic was just this incredible independent developer in the heart of Los Angeles that was just knocking them out of the park. They did the Battlefront games. They did the Full Spectrum Warrior. They did the Mercenaries games. They did a Lord of the Rings thing. They did Saboteur, which EA just,
I know that's one of your favorites, isn't it? Yeah,
it's amazing. It's great. And and so they kind of built this really sophisticated system of being able to you know, exploit these open world experiences again and again and again. I think they had the first PS3 the first PS3 dev kit that I saw. They showed it off, and it was just like this giant machine with fans everywhere.
I hadn't gotten it small yet.
Yeah, it was for what the devs could work on. But
well, they did the Clone Wars game too. I didn't know that.
Yeah, they were such an amazing group of people, so creative. And then they were acquired by EA, and then they basically got stripped for parts. You know, they get sort of subsumed into the EA ecosystem, and they kind of lost their identity, and people left the business or left the company and, you know, went off to do other things. But we always had a great time working with them on stories, and it was amazing to watch them sort of flourish. But it's really hard, man, to launch any game, but to launch a succession of smashes like they were doing.
They were crushing them.
Crushing
it. Do you feel nostalgic for that time? Like the early 2000s? It maybe it's just, you don't,
I do.
I just, you don't really, I, maybe I'm wrong, but it's just kind of the story. I feel like you don't see that as much anymore.
I miss it because of, I mean, it's twofold for me, because we had a pretty sizable team of people that I loved working with, and we were covering all of this stuff, but yeah, there was a never ending deluge. Like, I think that PS3 360 generation was an amazing time, because by that point, 3D game development was pretty sophisticated. And that's really well exemplified by Naughty Dog and Insomniac. And the, you know, Rocksteady coming out with Arkham Asylum.
Totally.
There was some, you know, the Force Awakens games, but there was this acknowledgement of how to maneuver around in 3D space. Everybody had a language that was kind of understood and common, and the cut sequences were just getting so cinematic and ridiculously ambitious. Like Metal Gear Solid 4 on PlayStation 3 was just, and we got to work on the making of that, and it was just amazing to see the creative thinking and the resources and the way that it was all figured out for us. It was amazing. And then I think what happened is that we pivoted to PS4, and there was just such a huge acceleration on making graphics higher resolution and better and more of them. And I'm saying graphics, and that's reductive, but like they had to look better, as opposed to just tuning what was working in PS3 and 360. And the other thing that happened is the explosion of mobile games and internet only games and internet derived games in PS4. And now we've pivoted to PS5 and Xbox Series X and modern GPUs and stuff. And they're still doing a lot of the sort of design work that was done at PS3 360, but now it's just really expensive with the fidelity and the, you know, trying to get those frame rates up at 4K resolutions. And even this hardware today can't always do that. So you're seeing a lot of struggle still, you know, and the games get longer and this, like this, let's increase the prices by $10. And then they're all fighting for this live service phenomenon where games are out there. Like next week, there's Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Next week, there's Ghostbusters costumes in Destiny 2. It's like, what are we doing here? You know, like I don't need to throw any shade at the Destiny fans out there, but like, let it go. You know, let's let some room in. Let's let the light in for some other things, you know? And I feel like the business is like constantly fighting each other to like, look at me, stay with me forever. And it's like, come on, guys, let's play some more stuff.
The thing I miss most from that era that is never going to come back ever is lining up for a game. Like for Halo 3, Halo 3 was like my ultimate game. And Halo Reach 2, really, and to a lesser extent Halo 4, but like lining up at EB Games, And now it's just digital. I don't even know if they do. I don't even think they do midnight launches anymore.
They're struggling, all the retailers. And what's different now is all the consoles are retailers. They're all stores themselves, you know. And
yeah, exactly.
They're trying to bring the business and do the deals to make their, you know, shopping through them very compelling.
And Game Pass is just such a good deal.
Like, and Game Pass is an amazing deal. And I think it's very good for consumers. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. Yes. All these subscription services, honestly, are good deals for the consumers. Yeah. But this actually is interesting because we just partnered with PMP Games as a sponsor for the classic content starting next Saturday.
Next Saturday, 9 a.m.
Yeah. And I wanted a retro retailer to be a part of this, because we're talking about games that people might want in their collections and stuff. And I would hazard to guess they're based in Winnipeg. They have a few stores there, but they distribute anywhere in North America. Mm-hmm. I would hazard to guess that they have a pretty darn cool community, much like I think a lot of the mom and pop, retro retailers. PMP, I think, is a little more sophisticated because they've got their whole online store and, you know, people everywhere are buying their stuff. But I think they probably still do midnight launches and special events. They just had a Mario thing where they had, and I think it's pretty cool to kind of search that out if you're missing that, you know. There's companies and stores that want to celebrate that. I think Limited Run is a pretty special company, you know. Maybe they're not perfect and maybe they have, you know, long waits on some of their stuff, but I think it's amazing that their whole motto is just staying with physical and celebrating the collecting quality of this. Mm-hmm. And I applaud all that, and I think that's really valuable. End game for me, though, is that we get more people playing and more interesting games and better and cooler Star Wars games.
You know, I spoke to a Star Wars Galaxy of Heroes content creator. Galaxy of Heroes, for those who don't know, is the mobile game. Mm-hmm. And there are people who routinely spend, and I'm not exaggerating, $100,000 on games like that.
Yeah.
Like they spend,
they're called whales.
Whales or Krakens if they're six figures. Right. And it's like, this is what's driving the decision making. Like Galaxy of Heroes has got to be the most profitable Star Wars game ever, I imagine. I mean, I'm not positive, but I would guess. It's been running for a decade and it earns insane money. So it's like, you know, this is why things are the way they are, partially anyway.
Yeah, I hate, you know, people have jobs and they you know, it's a job for them. But I'll
shame them. Don't worry. No, I'm joking.
Well, what I don't like is that they're just slotted into the art that people are really trying to make with games, like really pushing for. That's why a game like Alan Wake 2 is so freaking special. When you play that, it's like, wow, you know, I mean, it was an expensive indie game, you know, it's like, well, these guys really did something wacky here. This is not for everybody. And it's so committed to, you know, like it's freaking cool. I feel that way about what Nintendo puts out most of the time too. It's like, cause they know they've got their bangers that will sell, like a Mario or a Zelda game, but they'll also play in, you know, with different IP that they haven't brought out for a while, like that Endless Ocean game that they've just announced and stuff. And they'll either remake, I forget the name of, there was a recollection thing. I can't remember the name of the game. I didn't really groove on that because it's kind of more slower paced adventure, but I love that Nintendo goes, we're pulling this from, you know, the vault. And we're going to celebrate this. I love that Nintendo celebrates their whole thing, but they celebrate every release like that. And I think that's a really cool thing, you know? And they don't all hit like Zelda.
But that's kind of the risk.
But I love that, though. And, but they see the art in all of that work. And they see the, you know, that for how X number of people, that's really going to be the thing that
there's some dude who's thought about nothing but like the newest like obscure Nintendo franchise that hasn't had an entry since like the 80s.
Crap his
pants.
You know, like Fire Nintendo Emblem Direct has become a juggernaut, but it wasn't always. And I think that's probably the lesson that they learned, right? Like it wasn't always the huge, you know, surefire hit that it has now become. And they would celebrate every freaking Fire Emblem that's coming out. I reviewed the first one on the Game Boy Advance. I'm like, this is really cool, you know? And it had already had 10 years in Japan that I was completely oblivious about. But now they come out and they're like freaking amazing games that cross over, and there's, you know, people dressing up as the characters and it's cool to see. And I guess that's what they know as a company, is like, they don't know, so let's treat all of these things with that amount of love and let's get them out there. And they're also busy. That's the other thing too, right? Like game makers are so freaking busy and so heads down on what they're building. They don't have time to really, they don't know. There's so much optimism. Like they're just going to put it out. Like, hopefully this works, you know, and the marketers are also busy and they're like five projects ahead and they're looking at their budgets and stuff. It's a lot of fingers crossed. And that's why, you know, in the sort of, you know, big money world of EA, they go, well, we don't think the Mandalorian is going to make it. And maybe that's because, I mean, we don't know. Maybe they have the movie and that's it. You know, and EA doesn't want to do the 3 years more it will take for the Mando thing because the movie will come out and then that'll be it. You know, who knows?
Corey, did you have any questions you wanted to ask Vic?
No, I think we're good there.
This was an excellent conversation.
I sure talked a lot.
I was going to say Nintendo is kind of the perfect counterpoint to the rumors about why they were getting rid of the Mandalorian game. We think they only want a Star Wars game with a lightsaber. People aren't going to play a Star Wars game without a lightsaber, so we're not going to try that. Whereas Nintendo people, whatever Nintendo does announce, they just say, oh, what is this crazy thing Nintendo is doing? And then it either goes horribly wrong or it's the Switch and it just dominates everything for the next 10 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see how they follow that up too, right? Like that they're not in an easy position, but Nintendo never is. And they always, you know, do it their own way and they figure it out. You know, it's always fun.
So Vic, I've got a question. I got a, just a random question. What's the most excited you've ever been for a video game? For me, it was probably Skyrim, maybe Elden Ring. What about you? What's the most excited you've ever been?
Oh, Jesus. Halo 3. Oh my God.
I would have guessed one of the Batman games.
I think it was Arkham Knight because I loved Asylum and City so much, and we were getting a next generation Batman, and he was going to have the Batmobile, and I, you know, that's my favorite Batmobile. Like they actually had one at E3. Out of all the Batmobiles that I've ever seen in the comics or the movies, that's like my favorite Batmobile. I just love the whole thinking and the design on it.
Yeah.
And so the buildup was enormous for that. You know, I was super excited about Uncharted 3 because I loved Uncharted 2 so much.
Massive game. Yeah.
Yeah. As you know, Force Unleashed 2. I guess generally they're kind of sequels. Red Dead Redemption 2, I couldn't wait I ended up liking one more than two. Mm-hmm. Burnout 4, but I like 3 more than 4. Yeah, it's something like that. But I think out of all of them, good question. I think it's Arkham Knight.
Burnout 3 was an all-time game. So
all-time, man.
Yeah.
I actually do have a kind of similar question. With all the field pieces you were talking about doing for EP, is there any particular location or field piece that really sticks out to you? Like, I know you did the pandemic stuff with Battlefront, and that was really cool when those were coming out.
I think those are the ones that, because I was directing those, and so I was quickly putting storyboards together and then putting people in places and sort of picking the shots and working with the camera operator to kind of figure out how to piece the story together. And so when I think about, you know, my favorite day out in the field with EP, those are really, really fun. But I've had really fantastic interviews along the way, been able to just chat with all kinds of really cool people. And like meeting Shigeru Miyamoto for the first time and stuff like that. Just awesome. But I think it's those Battlefront pieces. They stick out for me. But anytime we get to visit LucasArts, I'll tell you something about LucasArts. They knew how much they meant to us as TV show people, like making a TV show and talking about Star Wars and all that stuff. They could see it in my face too, how much I revere the worlds of Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And they were always open for us and ready to play and ready to, you know, do different silly things and have their staffers get killed in hallways and, you know, chase us around their parking lot. If I dressed up as Indiana Jones for one of the pieces that we did, and they just had, I don't know, a lot of trust and respect for us. And I'm friends with lots of those people now. They not tons of them work at LucasArts anymore, but they were all wonderful. And that was a really, it's those moments, man, because when you're building something like this or anything where you're like doing, I mean, this was our business to business, right? Like we were having to go out in the field and work with these people, and they had to trust that we were going to put stories together. And when you have an ally like that, that really does, it starts to make it all work, you know, like we can't do it without them letting us in and working with us and playing with us. And they did that. And because of that, it puts air under your wings and you just keep going, you know, and then we can show our other people that we work with that, look at this crazy thing we did with Lucas. Maybe you'll let us pretend that there's an ejection seat in the car that we're going to do. and they would let us do that, you know? So it was a lot of fun.
So I heard, because I did some of the pre-release stuff for Squadrons. They were initially going to have a full X-Wing out for one of the big events, but COVID canceled it. So they end up sending it to a streamer, which stinks, because I would have liked to sit in the X-Wing.
Oh, but yeah. There was a guy at LucasArts, I can't remember his name, but he was, you know, they're busy hunkered on computers, but he liked to create physical things. And so you've seen them in EP if you watched our Star Wars pieces, but he built like the alien walker thing, and he built an X-wing in the hallway. Yeah. And there was the pod racer. He built a pod racer in there, and we used those props all the time while we were visiting.
When we did the preview for Jedi Survivor in LA, they had like the back to tank with Deg and Garrett floating in the press room.
You gotta love that.
He's watching you pee. It's like probably an HR thing.
No, I love it when game companies kind of celebrate the work in a tangible, physical way like that, and they have the concept art and stuff up on the walls. So much work goes into these things, and then it's just gone. Next thing, you know, it's kind of crazy.
Oh, Vic, have you ever been in Tommy's Spider-Man room?
Yes, of course. Yep. Just did lots of shoots down there.
What's that house like? Like, is every room just wild, or is it just...
Oh, man, there's going to be EP episodes that we shoot in different rooms because it's kind of like a crazy museum, you know? He's a collector that had more money than us, you know? So he would buy actual arcade. Like, I have these things, but he has like physical arcade machines and statues and things like that. And, you know,
so is he just doing was he just working for the pure fun of it then back in the day?
Well, he was doing well. He was working all the time with...
No, I mean, like with you guys, projects. Like if he was he just, did he just love video games that much? He wanted to talk about them.
Yeah. And I think it was, you know, from our perspective, when I asked him to join the show, I wanted to work with somebody that had a familiarity in the industry and knew, you know, who the companies were and you know, what we were going to be talking about. And he was very personable on camera, and it was a good fit there. And from his perspective, he definitely liked that he had this position of, you know, notoriety with a program like that. And it was a good fit, and we got along, and, you know, our relationship is there for everybody to behold as we go week to week on the show. Episode to episode.
I don't know if it's just a Canadian media thing, but it might be a strange comparison, but with like the late 90s to early 2000s, you have Electric Playground doing what you guys were doing, then like the Rick Mercer Report doing across the country with those field pieces, compared to a lot of the in-studio American stuff, or even in the parody direction, the Red Green Show having... They have their main studio, but then they go out and do the adventures with Bill and everything. So I don't know if it's
even Trailer Park
just a secret sauce that Canadian media found that I feel like we've kind of gone away from. But
well,
like
I'll tell you,
those field pieces.
Much Music was a huge inspiration.
Yeah,
for me.
Totally.
The energy that Much Music had, the kind of make it up as you go, and the
Much On Demand.
I think. Yeah, and the, you know, the intimate and interactive stuff, like those we live for that. We live for those moments that feel authentic. And I think when you're making television or all of this clenched stuff now, you know, like if you it's so easy to get it's so easy to be totally unprofessional and just, you know, fall into the spiral of being super negative and chasing clicks and, you know, just fueling that side. And it's also so easy to get too corporate and too clenched and too uptight about what you're putting together. And I saw that in lots of stuff that, you know, has been produced around this media. Yeah. And what we endeavored to do, and what I've always tried to do with the people I've talked with, is let's just be people, you know? Yeah. And I think the people that are really thriving on YouTube and other sort of media channels and services right now are very much in that line. But yeah, I agree. I think one of the absences out there is getting out, you know, and the pandemic.
Yeah. COVID did not help.
Yeah. Like the pandemic, I think, pushed that forward even more. Like we just got used to this, and this is great that we have this at our disposal, by the way. It's fantastic. Right.
It's not the same.
I would have loved to have had the ability to do this sometimes, because
it's kind of nice you didn't, because maybe you wouldn't have done the other thing, you know?
True. Yeah. Yes. And now we know exactly how to do the other thing.
In Japan.
Exactly.
It's funny. You made the Much Music comparison. I sort of, you know, whenever I see somebody like Rick Campanelli or George Strombolopoulos, like on Much Music back, and they're like, oh, they're from Much. It's kind of the same whenever I see someone who was on your show, like Marissa. I see her on like I think it's I think she's with Sportsnet. I see her all the time. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
Marista from Reviews on the Run or EP Daily, or I guess it was EP Daily that she was on for. So kind of a
similar. She's awesome. Yeah, I'm so proud of her. Yeah, she's just killing it. She's really pivoted beautifully into this new kind of digital media ecosphere. I miss the Chum days. And the whole Much Music vibe. Chum was a pretty incredible partner for us. Yeah. They were the first company that really stepped up for us nationally. Huh. They put us on the new VR stations across the city, across the country. And then Space stepped up. I met Moses Neimer at, we used to go to these television trade shows called NatP, where we would pitch the show or sometimes, and then later we became press and we'd shoot interviews and stuff at them. And, our first station was a Bellingham, Washington station that services Vancouver. And so they're just right over the border. So our first station technically was an American station that we signed. And that whenever you leave Canada and go and do any business in America, Canadian businesses are like, wait a second. Can we, you're cool. Can we do something with you too? You know? And we had a little bit of that. So we,
I'm cool first, now. Okay.
Yeah. You know, we've got a show sort of percolating in the States. And maybe you'd like it here too. And we had people that saw the opportunity and they went for it. And man, I can't thank my allies, everybody, especially my wife who, you know, just believed my crazy fever dream and just supported me all the way and helped me run the actual company and handle all of these incredible employees. I can't thank my allies there, but also enough. They're all freaking marvelous and man, they made dreams come true. But the partners we had were also really incredible because they left us alone. They really trusted that we knew what we were doing and we did, but we were also figuring out a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was all new. It was all, you know, it was a wild west, you know.
Absolutely.
And it was very fun. And we just kept going and keep going.
Well, I think that's everything that I had. Corey, anything you want to end with? Or should we send Mr. Lucas on his way? And
thank you for joining us.
Yeah.
Oh, this was really fun. I apologize for monopolizing and
no.
If I wanted to hear so Corey much. Talk, I would just talk to Corey. I've had enough of him.
Watching EP was one of the reasons that before I got into YouTube, before I went to university, I was thinking about going into game development. So seeing all the stories you guys did was huge impact on my life as well. So thank you for doing all that. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, keep it up, you guys. And thank you. I love to come back anytime you're going to want to nerd out about any Star Wars stuff. I hope everybody that's watching and listening is also following the Bad Batch. It's an amazing show. I can't speak more highly of it. It's just incredible. Yeah. But you guys are great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Maybe when Outlaws comes out, we can talk a bit of
that. That would be great, actually. Maybe an Outlaws would discussion.
Love it.
Right. So for everyone who enjoyed listening to Vic, all his links will be down in all the YouTube descriptions. You can check out EPN, just YouTube, search EPN, but also click the link. Not only for that, we talked a lot about the classic episodes, but lots of daily coverage of video games, movies, everything that you might enjoy. So check that out, drop a subscription, and we'll see you guys next time.
Bye,
thanks,
everyone.
You guys. Thank you. Bye-bye.